All right. You guys here last week? We talked about waiting last week. Waiting. And I promised you a follow-up to that, as well as talking about how do you know when you're not supposed to wait. A couple of the quotes from last week, a couple more Bonhoeffer, so you're going to get your fill of him today. Whoa, that didn't work.
In the morning, when I arise, in the morning,
okay, one
when
moment,
I rise, in the morning,
so wakes up, does better.
When I arise, give me
Jesus. Kind of important, it's worked right for me, if you can't see it. Ah, that looks better.
Give me Jesus. Give me Jesus. You can have.
Let's try that.
All this world. Just give me Jesus.
There we go. All right, a couple of Bonhoeffer quotes here. So, this is it, again from that same book, God is in the Manger. And this was a letter he wrote to his fiance 2 years before he was executed. He says, celebrating Advent means being able to wait. Waiting is an art that our impatient age has forgotten. And I agree that it is an art. It's something you have to work at, because waiting is just really a miserable thing. He ends this writing by saying, for the greatest and most tender and most profound things in life, we must wait. And I will echo that in my life. The things that I've had to wait on, be patient on, and then finally let God show me the way that He had mine. Those have become the ones that I talk about the most. If you're having trouble waiting, you're good company. 2,000 years ago, a guy named Abraham, God promises Abraham that He is going to essentially save the world through his family, through his offspring. Abraham's an old guy. He's in his mid-80s at the time that promise was made to him. And he thought it was pretty crazy that he'd have kids at that age, since him and his wife, Sarah, hadn't had kids. So he starts the waiting game. He does exactly what most of us do. He decides at some point that he must be misinterpreting God, or not understanding that he's going to take it into his own hands. And so he decides that his wife has a maid servant, they call her, a handmaid, they call her. Hagar is his wife Sarah's handmaid. And so he decides to have a child with Hagar, and he does, and it's not what God had planned. Get into that story. There's all kinds of interesting things that happen. God ultimately worked through it and did well. Ultimately, when Abraham continued to wait, he did have his own child. Things worked the way God wanted it. But it's the way we tend to work. God gives us option A. We don't like waiting for option A, so we choose option B. And if you look at Christ, again, in some ways it's not fair to look at Christ, because He was perfect, and when we struggle being that, we can certainly learn from Him. Christ didn't wait very often. Christ, I think of the woman at the well situation. Most guys, if there's this woman at the well who's been married about 5 times, there's something about her that is pretty magical to guys, all right? So the guys have a hard time not liking this woman. And if she's at this well hanging out by herself in a culture where guys aren't supposed to talk to women, and one of you were to say to me, hey, you think I ought to go up to that girl and try to help her out? I'd say, stay a mile away from her. No way. I'd rather wait. Find some girl to go with you and talk to her. But Jesus didn't. And it's like, well, why did Jesus not wait? Why did He do things like that? And maybe we have to be more cautious about it, because He wasn't. He wasn't. You guys remember the marshmallow video last week? Who was here last week? Anybody? Okay, so a few of you. All right. So last week we talked about this old study where they have kids. They give them a marshmallow, and they talk to the kids about the fact that if they'll wait on eating the marshmallow, they can have a second marshmallow. And they actually tried to get them to wait 15 minutes. And these are four-year-olds. Can you imagine a four-year-old waiting on that? Well, they went on over the years. They found that at age 20, kids that had trouble waiting for the second marshmallow at age 4 had trouble in life at age 20. This inability to wait followed them through life. They studied him again at age 40, and guess what? In terms of what we would call these kind of social expectations, in terms of holding down a job, being this functional person in society, these types of things, these kids that struggled at age 4 were still struggling at age 40. This is where it gets intriguing. In 2012, they did another study. And the idea was like, what are the other factors involved in the marshmallow study? So get my microphone ready here and let's just watch this. Night is weighing heavy now. Be quiet and wait for a voice that will say, are something. Come
on,
We wanted to manipulate children's beliefs about how reliable the environment they were in was. The scientists wanted two conditions: either the reliable condition or the unreliable condition. So for the art supplies that you're using, you actually have a choice. You can either use these crayons right now, or if you can wait for me to go get some from the other room, you can use our big set of art supplies instead. The kids in the reliable condition, when the experimenter came back into the room, had the better thing. And for the kids in the unreliable condition, the experimenter apologized and said she made a mistake. We didn't have that available and then helped them use the first option. And I'm so sorry, but you don't have that big set of art supplies as well. Sorry about that. But you can still use these ones to make your project.
A classic example of a task which children show impulsivity is what's called the marshmallow task.
For your snack, you have a choice. Wait just a second. Let me explain. So you can either eat this one marshmallow right now, or if you can wait for me to go get it from the other room, you can have some marshmallows instead.
What we found is an incredibly large group of children who are more likely to pick up learning on average. My children were violently waiting for that. They waited about 12 minutes, which is an incredibly long time for young children to wait before they get a reward.
The difference is maybe due to a difference in expectations about what's likely to happen in the world. That's what this experiment was designed to address.
Any 3-year-old, self-control is not necessarily at the top of their skill base. But in general, when she sets her mind that she's going to do something, she's going to do it.
In the marshmallow task, I was like, what you want to do is you want to get the most amount of marshmallow possible. But there may be other considerations. Even that I have this one marshmallow now that's guaranteed, what are the chances that if I wait, there's going to be a second marshmallow later?
If it was a teacher he had all the time, that they would have that trust bond a little bit longer, then he'd probably wait longer.
One of the lines of work involved is what happens.
The summary of this thing is that you see these kids. Oh, no, there. Stop it. Okay. So you see these kids that are at age 4. They can't wait on the marshmallow. And then they have this problem at age 20 and they have this problem at age 40. And the question is this just something kind of natural in these kids? Or is there something more going on here? Here's the chart from that study. These kids, these kind of youngish kids, 4 to 6 year olds, somewhere in that range, kids were put in this very, very simple, reliable, reliable versus unreliable environment. And all that meant was the kids had one example where the teacher had said, I was going to go get you some cool things to color with. And in the reliable environment, she came back with the cool things, just like she said. And in the unreliable, she came back very pleasantly. She was like, first she said, oh, sorry, turns out I couldn't get them. That little difference meant these kids in the reliable environment were on average able to wait about 13 minutes before they finally gave up and ate marshmallow. In the unreliable environment, about 3 minutes. That amazing. It almost makes me cry. I mean, I know it sounds kind of cool, but it really kind of emotionally hit me when I was reading this thing because of the number of people that I'm around in my life that really, really struggle with life. And I began to realize over time that a lot of it has to do with the way that they were brought up. And you start thinking about how many people are brought up in unreliable environments. You don't need to raise hands, but how many of you guys were raised in an unreliable environment? You were raised in an environment where you couldn't trust people around you. And so this idea of going into the workplace and having a boss say, if you do this for me, I'll do this for you, is not very meaningful. Because you've learned that, well, where I grew up, people said they would do this for me, never ever followed through and actually did it. How big of an impact is it? It's really crushing when you think about how big of an impact our ability to be reliable can really have on people around us. On people around us. Yeah. They've never had the ability to have something to lean on they can trust. And so it's something that if you don't buy into this, then I'd encourage you to at least consider buying into it. But in my life, I have found that God is a reliable environment. In fact, it's the most reliable environment. It's the most reliable thing that I've ever been able to find in my life. When people ask me, I'm an engineer, which means that since I'm a scientist, okay, so I'll go down that route. People start asking me questions about my faith and say, you know, as a scientist, as an engineer, you know, what about all the science that shows things that seem somewhat contradictory to the Bible? And what do you think about all that? And what about creationism and all these kinds of things? I always tell them that I kind of gave that battle up. It's just not my gig. It doesn't work for me. It's not something that makes a lot of sense and really helps me out. But this right here is what makes all the difference. Time and time again, when I have given up my hold on what I want in life or my hold on the way I want things to happen in my life, when I finally give that up, it's at that point that God, in His way, comes through and I can look back at it a year later and go, wow, you really are the revival. I will just put my faith, put my trust there. Work through it, then I can look back and see it later on. Now, wrote here, it says, if you're grounded in God and He's your foundation, you can confidently wait. Confidently wait. The tricky part this week is, but how do you know when to wait and when to act? Does anybody struggle with that? I think over the last 5 years, that's become a bigger deal for me. As I have learned to wait, sometimes I'm now almost too comfortable to wait. And so I'm constantly trying to know, like, when do I go? When do I not go? Because I used to be all about action. And I would just run ahead of God about 100 miles an hour. And but now I'm trying to figure this out. How do you know when to wait? And how do you know when to act? So, I'll tell you a little story. It's really easy. You just make the bed. This is one example. How many of you guys make your bed every day? Way to go. How many of you go to bed at night, most nights, and the bed still isn't made? Anybody willing to admit to that? But now, if someone's going to come over to your house and they might accidentally walk through your bedroom. Do you guys make the bed before friends come over just in case? Isn't that funny? Liars, you're giving the perception that you're something you're not, aren't you? Just make the bed. So I want to tell you this story. 22 years of marriage, that's what I've got behind me so far. Rarely have I made the bed. Like, I don't know why occasionally I would make it, but I would say out of the 365 days a year, I would make it, what, Jill, once or twice? Three times? I don't know. Jill, it wasn't a big deal to Jill, apparently. She didn't ever say anything about it, but I just never made the bed. Oftentimes, I was the second one up, because she gets up, cooks the kids breakfast while I'm still sleeping, because I'm lazy. And, but nope, Jill just does it. Doesn't seem to bother her much. And for me, it's just easier. It's easier to not do it, so I just don't. But magically, every night when I go to bed, because it's important to Jill that the bed be made, magically when I go to bed, it's made. Okay? So it's always made. So I don't know if I'd like it or not like it if it wasn't made, because it always is. So I just got used to that. But I got to thinking back a while. And I don't know what got me doing this, but my dad is in charge of the outside, okay? So if the driveway needs plowed, that's my dad. If firewood needs to be cut, that's my dad. Anything that goes on, once you walk outside the house, that's my dad's world, and he's in charge. Inside the house is my mom. And so everything says that my dad should be like me. He should have been someone to let my mom make the bed. And I'm sure my mom would have done it and never said a peep about it. But my dad always made the bed. Always. And it's kind of stuck in my mind. It's a good example for us to realize what our kids are watching. Because I remember that. My dad always made the bed. So a few weeks ago, something just got on my mind. I thought, I'm going to start making the bed. And so I started getting up in the morning. I get up second most of the time, so Jill's already gone. And I made the bed. And like the first day I did it, I think you texted me something like, "Wow, honey, thanks for making the bed." And I was like, okay, well, not only did she know that, she appreciated it. And about a week later, I can't find out what happened, but something came up and she made the comment to me about how much she really, really appreciated me making the bed. Now, keep in mind, this takes me about 2 minutes, right? Our bed is not a hard bed to make. I mean, get up, pull the sheets up, kind of hit them a few times. I probably don't do as good of a job as she wants me to do, but, you know, you kind of straighten out and you just make the bed. And so in terms of how do you know when to act? How do you know when to act? You act when the benefits are obvious. So there's some times that your actions are just very clear. You don't need, in terms of actions, to have taking out the trash be the gift that God has given you. That's what you were made. I wasn't made to take the trash out, so I don't take the trash out, okay? Sometimes you act when it's the simple things, when the benefits are really, really obvious and simple. I can look back now and I can tell how nice it is for Jill to see that I made the bed. And I make the bed, and so it's turned into a just really, really nice thing, okay? But it gets more difficult, by the way, when the benefits are obvious for God. When the benefits are obvious for you, it's less obvious. But this is something that really helps me think through in terms of your actions and what you're doing in life. And it's so important because we don't want to do it very often. And this wire is very crazy. This is something that my boss and I have talked about quite a bit at work. This ability to step back from the situation that you're in. You're trying to decide what actions are appropriate, what actions are needed, what actions are not needed. You step back. You try to erase your bias. You try to get rid of the things that wind you up or don't wind you up. You try to look at yourself. Hey, this is absolutely key. Find out from people. We were having a year-end review. I was having this with my boss, and it really kind of startled me. He's a neat Christian guy, so we have really, really great discussions this time of year. And he was writing down different things. We have OAR. It means something to do with what I've done in a year. So he's writing this down, he's basically grading me for a year. And he says to me, he says, you know something that you do that I really, really like? All right, bring it on. And he says, when people criticize you, you're really good with it. He said, you're really okay with it. you'll get all defensive. You don't get all wound up. And he said, I found over the year that's kind of odd. And I sort of chuckled, and I said, you know, that's interesting, because I agree with you. That we don't see that all that often, and it is something I work really, really hard at. But I told him, what I have found, and this is the beauty of how God works, what I have found is that when I get criticism, and I embrace that criticism, and I actually appreciate it, it's the easiest thing to do.
Let the earth be glad.
We think of it as being a hard thing to embrace criticism. I find it's actually the easiest thing to do. Because whenever I fight back and I try to stand my ground, it always causes me grief. It causes tension. It causes conflict. When someone comes to me and says, hey, Glenn, I think you're a jerk. I think your idea is wrong or whatever. I've learned the absolutely easiest thing to do is to say, let's talk more about it. Let's work through that. Maybe there's something to be learned there. Maybe you're right. But we'll figure it out and we'll work through it. And so it was funny, as he was challenging me and saying, I really appreciate that you do this, I was saying back to him, the crazy thing is, I found that to be the easiest thing to do. It wasn't easy to get there. It was very hard to get there. But I really felt like, and I really still feel like, it's a godly value to be able to embrace this, look at myself from the outside, open myself up. And that makes a lot of sense. The reason I bring that up is because you're trying to decide what actions need to happen in your life. And oftentimes, it's coupled with what actions need to go away with. If all you're doing is looking at everything from your perspective, not willing to get on the outside, put the outside in, really, really. There was an elder question when Doug and I did these questions a few weeks ago. One of the questions we didn't get to that I got to later, so that I had an email, so some of you may have read this. The question to the elder from Doug and I was, how do you discern between God's will for your life, for the life of God, versus what you want for yourself and you beg God to bless? How do you know the difference? How do you discern between God's will for your life, what God wants you to do, versus what you want for yourself? Right? You got to struggle with that. I hope you struggle with that. You should. I struggle with that. And, whoops. Uh-oh. Let's see how it comes out. I did this before and got all messed up. There we go. Yeah, it is messed up, but we'll make it work. The answer for me, this is, I put a lot of thought into this question. It's really a wisdom and experience thing. Where we usually don't know the answer until we look back. That's what I found. Most of the time, I don't know the answer until I've taken some action, some time has passed, and I can look back. That's the only time I really, really know the answer with clear certainty. But it's really a wisdom experience thing where we usually don't know the answer until we look back at the fruits of what have happened. We look at what actually was the outcome. By clearly remembering how it felt when I was following God's will, versus when I followed my own, as I'm getting older now, this is age plays to your favor on this one. I am now better, and I am now better able to discern the difference. But it's still a daily struggle for me. This idea of trying to know when to do what and what not. I say the struggle is what we want to do, we convince ourselves of, versus what we ought to do. And I say that we confuse ourselves. These are just notes ahead of myself. We confuse ourselves. What we should be doing and what we should wait on someone else to do. And it's this whole idea of when do you act and when do you wait on someone else? When is it your gift? When is it someone else's gift? When is it time to just make the bed? When is there something going on around TLR here? It's just time to just step up and get it done. It's a struggle. I don't know, as one of the leaders here, how to push people in that front. I'm never quite sure. I'm always a little uncomfortable pushing kind of hard on that front. But the strange thing is, I've learned, just like making the bed, when someone is encouraged to make a step and do something in the right direction, there's always huge benefits that come back. For Jill and I, our marriage, it was just another little positive statement. I think you still appreciate it. Yeah. Want to keep doing it, I guess. So, yeah. You know, and it's really not a big deal, but it's just another positive step, another step toward God in our relationship by doing the little things that really help out. Wow, they're doing it. This next slide is going to take a few minutes to get through, okay? And in fact, I'm going to redo my computer screen here because what's happening is I'm going to get its size out of whack here, but we'll see what we can recover. All right, so this next slide will take a few minutes to get through. Oh, and one thing I wanted to point out at the end is the most important actions are really quite easy to figure out. I bring this up because there are the little actions that you don't have to have a gift from God to do them, taking out the trash, that kind of thing, making the bed. There's these little actions. You don't have to receive some vision from God to know that you ought to do a lot of these little things in life. Then there's these big actions that we convince ourselves of. So that's this one group over here, okay? Then there's this second group here that is the, I'm going to save the world for God, and I know exactly how I'm going to do it. I'm going to create this ministry, and I'm going to get these people to follow me, and I'm going to do this, and I've got all these big plans, all these actions that I want to do. But there's this third set over here. That's what I'm talking about right here. These are the actions that are really, really easy to discern, but we don't want to touch. These are the ones that, if we're really honest with ourselves, we know they need addressed. We know they're separating us from God. We don't want to touch them. So what needs action? Anything separating you from God is in this third room. You know what you chew on? Think about the things that are actually keeping you from doing and living the way you want to. I'm amazed as I watch it. I've seen in marriages a lot where there will be a marriage that's really, really having a difficult time. Okay? Things just aren't working. And they go off and they always want to do, like Abraham, they want to do plan B to fix the marriage. They want to buy something or start a new activity or whatever. There's always plan B. Wherein plan A is actually work on the problem itself. We so oftentimes want to walk around the problem. We say, oh, well, hey, I know I've got that issue in my life, but I'm going to work on all this other stuff, this middle group here I told you about that we like working on. I'm going to work on all this. That's no fun. So this is the slide I was going to talk about. What separates you from God? I want to take a few minutes and just kind of give a splattering of things that came to my mind. I wouldn't necessarily say that God put these on my heart. Maybe he did. I don't know. But I just sat down, I prayed a little bit, and I just made a list of things that I thought a lot of people might be able to relate with. That there might be one or two of these that can really stand out to you. So I'm going to leave them on the screen as I'm going through them. And you can decide whether or not you're doing terrible. But there is a thing. Let's see whether or not any of these jump out. Real simple. What about time for God? You spend an enormous amount of time serving God, but you actually have no time for God. I struggle with that. I was thinking about this recently. A podcast I was listening to was challenging people to take a few minutes before they get out of bed in the morning. To just pray. It's an easy time to do it. Find some time in the day to pray. You guys know I like to run, so I've been thinking through that, and my neighborhood, I run a lap, so my neighborhood takes me about 13 to 14 minutes to make a lap. I normally do 3 or 4 laps. And so I made a commitment that I'm going to start giving the first lap to God. And it's really worked out well. In fact, I ran the treadmill the other day, so there's no laps on the treadmill. And it was funny how as soon as I got on the treadmill without that little reminder, I just took off. I put on Survivor Man, and I was just having a great time watching Survivor Man on the treadmill. And about 13, 14 minutes into it, it hit me. I have to give a lap to God. So I pushed pause on Survivor Man, which was really making me angry because I was really enjoying the episode. It was one of my favorite episodes. You guys watch Survivor Man? This is the one where he dropped a plane and then he went and was living inside the plane and trying to figure out how you would be in a plane crash and simulated having broken arms. Anyways, and it was really kind of making me angry because I knew that by the time I took the next 13 minutes and gave that to God, I wouldn't be able to run long enough to finish watching Survivor Man. Isn't that crazy? But I can tell you that's what was going through. I said, oh, God, now I won't be able to finish this, and I know I'm not, once I stop running, I'm not going to run. But I did it, and I really felt good about it. So it's really working out well for me. What if God isn't your foundation? Again, these are kind of lightweight ones. What are you leaning on? What is what gives you value? What is it that gives you value? Is it your job? Is it someone you're dating or someone you want to get to know? Are you still trying to lean on parents? Maybe you had parents that were never a good foundation. You still wish they were a good foundation. And you're still trying to lean on them. And it's still particularly fulfilling. Oh, humility's for lesser friends than you and I. What about whether or not you yourself are a trustworthy person? Are you somebody that people can really lean on? Can you be a foundation? Are you a trustworthy person? Are the words you say the words that really have meaning to people? And when you commit to something, people know that you're really going to follow through. It's an obvious thing that we all want, but it's something that we don't all share. In the same way as I just said, are you a good foundation? If you're a parent, are you that parent that your kids know they can lean on at any time? If everything else in life is crumbling around your kids, and they're not mature enough yet to realize that they need to lean on God, are you the one they can lean on? What about coworkers? Do you have coworkers that are really, really struggling? And they don't know a lot about God, but they need somebody to lean on. Are you a good foundation? What about your relationships, your spouses, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever? Are you that rock-solid foundation they can trust in? Or are you the person that you actually use the foundation that you're setting up as a tool to scare and draw put fear in? You see that all the time in relationships. If you don't do X for me, I'm out of here. Marriages that happen. Marriages that someone will say, if this doesn't happen in our marriage, divorce you, I'm out of here. Or are you a really good man? You spend all your time focused on other problems, even though you've got this ginormous plank sticking out of your arm. You look around for all the issues. I hate it, but I see this in Christians all the time, and it just amazes me as it pops up. I see Christians come into a new Christian community. The first thing they want to do is a new church family. What do I mean by that? The first thing they want to do is start snooping around to see if there's anything they can find that they don't want. It's so easy. So there's no problem doing that. But we spend an awful lot of time being focused on everyone else's problems instead of our own. In the same way, you guys have anger problems. So as you focus on these other people's problems, that get angry. You struggle with that. You really get angry. A few years ago, I don't think anger has really ever been a massive problem in my life. There have been times I've been pretty frustrated. And there was a pivotal moment for me and Jill. We had a baby monitor, okay? So we had this baby monitor we'd set up in the house. We took this part that plays the sound and put it outside where we were working on some project right in the back of our yard. And forgot we left it out there. And that night, Chase crossed the line. I was really, really frustrated with you, Chase. And I can tell you, I let anger get the better of me that night. I was not the holy person I ought to be. And my voice is being raised. I was just going for it. Somewhere amongst that, my eye catches that little baby monitor sitting there. And I'm like, Jill, do you know where the other end of that monitor is? And she's like, we left it outside. Boy, hope nobody heard all this. And I look outside, and there it sits, right at the back of our yard, and right across the fence, they're having a big cookout. And there's like a big, like, fire pit thing with people sitting all up around the outside. And we thought, maybe they didn't hear. Maybe it's quiet enough they can't hear. And I walked over to my neighbor and I said, hey, sorry about that. You know, we're just going to have a bad time. He's like, yeah, don't care. He heard. It was good, though. It was good for me. It helped me to readjust. It was like, wow, if in that room with my child, if I was acting in a way that I'm embarrassed for the world to see, I was acting. Whoa. This is one, this is sort of an obvious one, the ideas of addictions and habits, but I want to bring it up because it's real, guys. If you're having porn addiction, drug addiction, abuse, physical abuse, verbal abuse, that's a big problem in your life. Tell you what, shut down all these other things you're trying to do, all your hobbies and all the things that's going on. Just start getting serious about it. Separating you from God. Your marriage, as I think about 2013, if we accomplished nothing as a community here other than solidifying all marriages here, that might be the biggest year ever. So it's what all these things happen. These seem like little individual things, but as you start conquering these separations from God, you start getting close to God. But if you're married, and yet you're trying to, I tell the guys who work all the time that it'd be a lot more fun at work. It's the humans that drive me crazy. I like the work. I can't stand the humans. All right? Broken world, and I'm part of it. Can you really serve a broken world? Can you accept that you're going to go out and do something nice for somebody that they're going to take advantage of? Feel free. I think as Christians, that's really good. We want to go out and help people. We want to do nice things. But when they don't respond the way we want them to respond, now all of a sudden we're not doing it. It's fine as long as everything's working the way we want it. How can I accept it as broken? No. Are you okay for 2013? Well, again, what I'm saying, these are areas that you can focus on in terms of actions, really important actions that are obvious. So stand here in 2012 and look back and think, were the things that happened this year or the point you're at right now, is this where you want to be? Are there any obvious areas that you're like, no, I really are there anything on the screen? Are you, when they meet you on Sunday morning, and then if they run into you at the workplace, are you the same person? Are you something completely different elsewhere? And which person are you really? You're probably not both. You're acting in one case or the other. But my boss is this guy that's not that way. And I recently said to him, I said, hey, what do you think about starting a Bible study at work? It's a French company. And so we were like, oh, I don't know. That's really not the French way. But we thought, you know, maybe we could pull this off somehow or another. And I told him, I said, well, here's what would be my thing. The focus of the study would be, how do we help our work environment? How do we help it be a better work environment? How do we take God's principles, Christian principles, and apply them to help all of us be better workers for the company? So that the company has meets its financial goals and does all the things that is right. My boss was like, no. It's like, you're right about us getting together and learning how to be better Christians and helping other people to work with you. But that's right. I can't say that 12 months from now the living will even exist. I also can't say that 12 months from now we won't have this place back. Who knows? Who knows what this place will look like? But I've learned I can't worry about it. I have to look at where I believe God is leading. I have to look at the areas of my life I'm struggling in and go from there. I got to remove separation from God. If there's separation, if there's stuff separating you from God, there is nothing else, I'm telling you, no other action that can be of any more importance. Don't let me push you to do something here at the living room that takes up a bunch of time that you need to be putting toward fixing your separation from God. Once you get that right, your ability to serve here or serve at the workplace or wherever you want to serve God is going to get. You got to clear the path for change. You got to listen. If there are things that you're not taking out of life, you got to listen. I told you last week about a house that I wanted to build, a property that I wanted to build. And God, basically, there's a weird way shot that I can put down some of it. In the same way, the house I'm in right now was obviously. I knew that I was on spring break in college. We came down my house and walked into this little house and walked out. And I couldn't quite figure out why. When I look back now, it's not possible because when I think God is leading me in the direction of something that I really, really want, I've learned I got to be really careful. When God leads me down a path of something that, I'm okay with it, but I'm not crazy about it, but I'm pretty sure that's where he's leading me, I'm usually confident that I'm right on and that I'm getting there. With this house was not the house that I could have bought. It was a couple 30% less costly. It was the least costly house we looked at. But if I had continued to let myself go down the path of what I thought, I can't encourage you enough to seek out my crazy. Work for Doug and I to bounce this off. When I say seek out wise counsel, this is asking not just if you're in a difficult situation, let's say you're in a dating relationship, seek out you're having trouble at work, find somebody that seems happy at work. They're the same work. They're doing the same job you're doing. You hate it, they love it. Seek out by that one. this is not. I see people in work with us that those things. Chase works at fast food, but it's too fast. And it's a good time working there.
People in that place, they're happy as a clam. All these people running around working like he comes home completely work because they are very, very busy.
Jerk. There was a jab in that, right? Why'd you say that to me? Or you could say to yourself, God, I know they shouldn't have said that. Forgive me. I'll get into that. But by the way, you said that. That is hard, guys. Being humble, accepting that. But you'll be amazed at the barriers that can break down. Being humble to take that one, to know that deep down inside I was serving God, I was doing the things that I felt like I ought to be doing, and have my boss say, hey, it's not good, you're not serving God like you think you are, back out. And so sure enough, I changed, I readjusted, and guess what, God used the situation, really. Guys, I hope that helped you guys. I hope as you dig into 2013, that if there are these obvious actions that need to happen, obvious change that needs to happen, that you guys can be bold enough to do it. There's nothing that excites me anymore for the next year than thinking about helping you guys through some of this stuff. So let me know, let Doug know what we can do to help. You guys may think that we have like some big, massive goal or in our minds, we want TLR to grow by numbers or whatever. I can tell you what I want, I believe God wants as well, and what I really believe God wants. I want you guys to grow. I want you guys to become better Christians. And want 2013 to be one that you can look back at Christmas time of 2013 and say, yeah, I am glad it was not 2000 like it was in 2012. I am so thankful to God that he's put these people in my life and these changes have occurred. And the result is that now that separation that was there, maybe I didn't even know it was there, but that separation from God is now, maybe not gone, but it's a whole lot. me pray, and then we can call it a day. We've got about 5 minutes till we need to pick up the kiddos. So you can just take a breather and then go get your kids. God. God, we thank you. We thank you for being a solid foundation. And God, if there are people here that don't understand or appreciate that you're their foundation, God, I just ask that you will show them somehow, through someone, how solid you are, and how your ways can be so beautiful. I ask that as a community, as we go to 2013, that we'll be there for each other, and that we can be a foundation for each other, a foundation that's leaning on your foundation. God, there's probably a few of us in this room that are, something's on our mind right now, and we know that this thing is eating us alive. It may be something I put on the screen, it might be something completely else that maybe you put on their heart during the talk. But I ask you to help us and help them to really, really embrace change, to embrace attacking that and taking action to make a change with them. Not ignoring it, but realizing that separation from you is not a good thing. And that if they can get rid of that separation, get rid of the selfishness or whatever it is that's driving them, that their life will be more beautiful. We read in the beginning about how peaceful a life with you is. And I thank you, God, that my life is more peaceful than it used to be. And as I get older and I learn more about leaning more and more on you, I'm amazed at how much peace you reflect back at me. But I want to keep it to myself. I want us all to have it. I want to be able to share it. So, we thank you for this day. We ask that you will, that your spirit will be on our hearts and on our minds as we go into this new year. We ask that we can bring you great joy with our lives. It's through Christ we pray. Guys, have a great day.